You are listening to The Link, an interactive podcast hosted by public policy experts at the U.S. Oncology Network. Your link to the policy that matters most.
All right, welcome to The Link, linking your practice to policy. My name is Ben Jones, and this is The Link podcast, joined today by J.C. Cardenas and Lisa Langenderfer and our special guest, Susan Niskey-Pomp. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks. Thanks very much for including me.
Absolutely. So we are live on set at the annual conference in beautiful but cold Indianapolis, Indiana. Excited about a couple of days. Yeah. What are you thinking? How's the conference look? How's the agenda look so far to you?
Yeah, I'm really excited about this. When I looked at the agenda and I saw how much opportunity there was for sharing across the practices, that's what really got me juiced about this. That is the key to drag people out of clinic and postpone them seeing patients when we pay so much attention to how quickly we get patients in and how much we care for them. To be able to pull people out of clinics, there's got to be a really good topic. And I think we've got so many great topics on the agenda today. And I am actually really excited for the unscripted section, not just because I'm in it, but also because I think that's going to be a nice opportunity to hear from the practices exactly what they're doing and how they accomplished it with the support of the network.
I agree. I'm excited about those. It's a novel concept, I think. Typically, I think we're starting to really move away from the death by PowerPoint, which is good. And we talk about all of the different aspects of U.S. oncology, but also from the practice's perspective. Short sessions, but enough to get a sense of what's happening on the ground. I think that's, I'm excited about that as well. Lisa? There's a lot going on in the policy realm as well. And this meeting is happening at a very interesting time. What are you most excited about?
Well, I think by far I'm most excited that Congress finally passed legislation last week and it was signed into law over the weekend to provide a bit of a mitigation in the cuts that we're seeing from Medicare. So that will take effect last weekend and go through the end of the year. So I'd love to hear, Susan, your thoughts on what a big deal that is for radiation.
That is a huge deal for us, and I'm so excited. And thank you for all of your hard work on that, because it's just been one hit after another in an area where we are spending more on technology to make sure we're getting those cutting-edge treatments, where we're spending more on staff, because the staff, particularly in radiation, are so specialized that any relief at all, and this is tremendous relief, any relief at all is really helping the practices.
Yeah, we're really excited about it. Also prepared for this year's fee schedule coming out, and we're probably going to have to do the same thing at the end of this year. So yeah. We appreciate your support.
So, Lisa, I think Susan brings up an interesting point, which is inflation has really driven up the costs for everything. It costs more money to see patients. And it's fascinating to me that before this, and even still even after this, they're trying to drive down reimbursement. What argument finally like held the day to get that across the finish line?
I mean, I think it was exactly that. I think we had a huge chorus of stakeholders saying and pointing out that the physician fee schedule is the only fee schedule that doesn't have an inflationary component, which is wild. But I think for our purposes, you know, we were in every day sharing, you know, everyone is opposed to consolidation. We want to support independent practices. But we're perpetuating the cycle when CMS is increasing reimbursement for outpatient hospital centers and decreasing reimbursement for independent physicians. So this is key in helping us reduce that gap.
Yeah. Ugh. All right. Well, there's a lot going on. It is crazy. And JC, I know you've been really watching all the movement on MID home delivery restrictions and really hoping that Congress will come forward with some solution.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a problem that is a self-inflicted wound.
Yeah.
You should at least discuss solutions. Talk to us about the hearing.
Yeah. So actually right now it's a perfect time because as we speak, they're actually the Energy and Commerce Subcommittee on Health is actually marking up 19 different bills, one of those being the MID home delivery bill, which is been in the works for a good amount of time now. We've been working with CMS, and CMS continually is putting it back on Congress to try and do it. So we're very happy that Congress is finally taking at least the first step in that. But yeah, this has been a long going effort, and we've actually been able to do a lot of Hill meetings and taking a lot of physicians up through virtual meetings to meet with staffers, just talking about the impact of patients, because it has really been a big disruptive issue for practices. And Susan, I don't know if you've heard anything else about how practices are able to mitigate that, or, you know, just being able to deal with that issue. I mean, we're very happy that it's happening. We're hopefully it'll go through faster than anything, but, you know, we're still at the whims of how Congress is moving.
Yeah, I think the best thing the practices can do is really support your efforts and try to make it known in the community where we're headed, because the community is our advocate.
Yeah.
And those are also people that we want to be talking to, because we're the alternative care for them, or we are the alternative to a large hospital system as the provider of care for them. So we make it easier. We do it faster. We do it better. And in many ways, we do it cheaper. So I think the best position for the practices is really to be able to support that at this point.
Yeah. And that's one of our big messages that we've been taking to the Hill. And I think we're hopefully finally breaking through a little bit on that.
Yeah. And Susan, give us a preview of what you're going to talk about in your unscripted session.
I love a commercial. Thanks for the opportunity to talk about that. So as radiation and imaging, our team is really built to support the practices in selecting technology. So both hardware and software, in trying to get best-in-class pricing, in providing expertise for physics and dosimetry, as well as workflow and policies and procedures. And most recently, a dashboard that provides data that's comparable for each of the practices across the network. So if you want to see where you stand in terms of productivity or disease site mix, you now have an opportunity to look at that across the system. So in thinking that that's what we've got as our product to take out to the practices, to be able to talk with a practice, with Debbie Barnes, who's the executive director of Missouri Cancer Associates, to be able to say, here's what we did together. Here's, in very early days, we've only been at this for about 8 weeks. Here's what we've been able to do in terms of saving time per day, measurable hour and a half of time per day, and in saving expenses, in reducing expenses for staffing. Now, the practice has got a lot of work to do to get there, but at least we were able to sit with them and share our experience, share the metrics and the data, and have them be able to make real changes within the practice that'll be better for the future.
Hey, Susan, let me ask you about some of these changes to direct supervision of radiation oncology. I see a lot of attention with some of the stakeholder groups. Can you give us your perspective?
Yeah, I think the direct supervision is a tricky path forward, especially coming off of COVID and the rules around not having to have on-site supervision. So we're going from that to now shifting to direct supervision, which I think is going to be pretty onerous on the physicians, and it's going to change the way that we practice. So there are definitely some concerns around that, particularly since it's something we're talking about only for freestanding sites.
Yeah.
So if we go back to that really big difference in the payment for hospital-based versus community, we're talking now about separate rules in for the same group of people. I think it's going to make it tough for us going forward.
I agree. I think the economics are purely, truly, and directly impacting community practices.
Right.
And this is just one more piece that kind of adds that layer of, what are you doing?
Right. And if there were a quality difference, I think that would make a difference.
Absolutely.
If we had a documented purpose for doing this because of improved quality, great. Nobody would be arguing with that, but we don't have one, right? We see nothing, and you're not asking another group that does the same exact treatments to have that same supervision. So again, from a quality perspective, I'm just failing to see how there's any real benefit.
Yep.
Well, and we're the ones in the rural settings, right? Like, we're the ones that are taking the care to the patient in those rural areas.
That's right.
And this seems like it'll have a direct impact on our ability to staff those locations.
Yep. That's right.
And Lisa, it's a perfect segue, because one thing that would absolutely help in solving some of this would be to level the playing field in reimbursement across sites of care. How's that issue gaining momentum?
You know, we've been pleasantly surprised to see that it really has gained a lot of traction over the past year and a half or so. Congress had about a dozen hearings on that issue last year. And actually, the House passed legislation at the end of December that would require essential payments for drug administration services in Medicare. So our top priority going into this coming year is to get that over the finish line in the Senate and move forward on that. So that's just one piece of it. It's just the drug administration part. But we were able to speak to how this would be impactful across the oncology spectrum. And there's even bills out there that are broader that would require essential payments across any service that's safely provided in the physician office setting.
That's great. That will make such a huge difference. So thank you for your work on that.
JC, we didn't ask you, what are you looking forward to most on the agenda?
For me, I'm a little bit over a year and a half in. I love learning a little bit more about the network every single day. Being able to talk to a lot of the physician and practices and then meet some of the other business units within the oncology network really helps me understand all the work that we're doing and how we can better advocate on the Hill to members to showcase the practices and showcase the physicians. So for me, it's really just meeting more people and networking with all the members of the network.
Good. Yeah, that's always one of the most enjoyable times about the annual meeting, bringing everybody together, sharing best practices, but also just sharing some time together and really understanding what's the most important issue that they're all facing. So that's how we can be most effective. So
yeah.
Good. Yeah, it's only a year and a half in.
Yeah.
Wow.
Getting those sidebar conversations of what people are experiencing in the different practices in the different states. It's always good just for us to have that background knowledge, especially for me as I'm still learning a lot more. So it's really helpful.
Nice.
But yeah.
Summarize your last year and a half in one sentence.
I was going to say fast.
Uh-oh.
It's been able to do a lot, and there's been a lot happening over the past year, and I think the work that our physicians are doing is really helpful to us being able to take that to the Hill and being able to showcase that. So I think it's definitely been a fast learning experience for sure.
Yep.
And fun.
And for the practices, having that face time with you all, having you here and sort of being able to just go out and talk to the practice presence makes a huge difference.
Yeah.
The things they didn't think to say on a Zoom call with 85 people, they are absolutely going to say to you when you're walking down the hall.
Yeah, exactly.
That's exactly right.
And us being able to take that message to the Hill is really important. So,
absolutely. All right. Well, thank you very much, Susan, for joining us for this episode of The Link, linking your practice to policy. Look at that. We didn't even talk about politics, too. This is good. We survived the first episode of the annual conference recording. Yeah. Thank you for listening in. Thank you for joining us. As a reminder, the views and opinions expressed today are those of us and us alone. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to The Link Podcast, your link to the legislature. For more information on healthcare policy and the U.S. Oncology Network, visit www.legislink.com.
All right, we are back on the Link Podcast, linking physicians to policy, and we are back here today with Dr. Scott Herbert, who is the practice president of Nexus Health in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hi, Dr. Herbert.
Good morning.
How are you today?
I'm getting there.
Yeah.
Need some more coffee, but I'll be there.
It's been one of those days.
Yeah.
It sure has. And for listeners, I'm Angela Storseth Cooper. I am our Senior Director of Government Relations, and I oversee our state policy team. And Dr. Herbert and I are presenting today at the annual meeting in Indianapolis on anti-competitive behavior, focusing on a little bit of insurers, pharmacy benefit manager, vertical integration, and talking a little bit about some anti-competitive behavior with hospitals that we are seeing in your market. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
You bet. It was a nice soft sell intro there. You know, Nexus Health was in a unique position. I'll give you just a second of background. So for 150 years, Santa Fe in northern New Mexico was essentially under one hospital. And because of that, you either worked with the hospital or for the hospital. And they, in essence, held payers hostage. They were a level three trauma center, and they negotiated very strongly with payers. And subsequently, Santa Fe became the most expensive place to get care in the state. And this hospital became the most profitable hospital in the entire Christus Health network because of these practices. In about 2018, a second hospital was built in Santa Fe, and we as a provider group felt that that gave us an opportunity to differentiate ourselves in the market as the outpatient center of choice that could compete on quality, efficiency, and especially price. You know, both of these hospitals participate in 340B. Both of these hospitals have HOPD pricing for both the oncology clinic as well as all of their subspecialties. So Nexus Health formed. We formed as a multi-specialty group. We have about 13 different specialties in our group right now. And that was our overall plan. as you can imagine, the reaction to this new market entrant was not overly positive. Mm-hmm. You know, we were in an MSA and PSA with Krista's Health for over a decade, and the oncology program was responsible for roughly 70% of their margin annually. It's worth big bucks to a hospital system. And so when we elected not to renew our contract and start a new group, the response was vigorous.
Right. So when you started to hear some negative sort of response to from the hospital about you guys forming your own group, definitely taking on oncology care, what were some of those pressures that you were up against? And to a second part of that question, when you started to feel those pressures, did you ever think to connect with the policy team?
So I can tell you somewhat embarrassingly, I was unprepared for the hospital's response to our decision. You know, from a strategic standpoint, Nexus Health has been able to hit its mark. We've been able to build, we've been able to accomplish the things we wanted to do. But without a doubt, over the last 2 years, every time I said they could never do X, they did X a week later. And we felt just almost completely reactive for a while until we took logic out of the equation and sort of replaced it with malice. You know, our practice was not prepared for this. And I think our first response, and probably most people's first response, is this isn't fair. Let's contact an attorney.
Right. Yeah.
And that's absolutely the road we went down. I think, you know, in hindsight, I'm not sure I would have done that again, because it was a lot of time, a lot of money, and a practice like ours simply does not have the resources to battle this out in the court of in a court of law. We don't. They have attorneys on salary, and they will just sit and grind you into the dust. So only partially through the process did we get introduced to the public policy team and really start to understand that this fight would be better served in the fight of public opinion and public policy rather than the setting of law.
Absolutely. Can you share, if you feel comfortable sharing, some examples of the X that you talked about? And then maybe we can touch on some of those first steps we took as a policy team with you to start creating some of those relationships in Santa Fe.
Sure. You know, the hospital's initial response to our decision, like they wanted the practice to fail. Everything they did was not around patient care. It was not about continuity. It was about making it impossible for us to succeed. And so, you know, we gave a year's notice on our contract as required. And then 3 months into that year notice period, they made a decision to try to terminate our contract early. Now, we didn't have payer contracts in place. They didn't have enough physicians to cover the patients. It was clearly an impossible situation. But that was number one, and it just sent the entire practice reeling. Oh my Lord, this is never going to work, et cetera, et cetera. And for that part, we had to go to the community and say, look, there's going to be thousands of people who will not have a doctor June 1st, and there's not a solution unless the hospital drops this. So that was sort of their first big salvo. Number two, they started hiring an army of locums to compete with us. Now, typically, locums are meant to replace a physician on vacation or maternity leave or injury. They weren't really meant, in my opinion, to build a program. But at $5,000 a day, they would recruit locum after locum after locum to compete with an established group. So that was number two. Is it technically legal? Probably not. I mean, I think if you're arguing, but is it simple and easy to prove or get them to stop? No. Is it cheap to get them to stop? No. The next thing they did is they started telling all of our patients that we had left town, that we had retired, that we no longer took care of breast cancer, referring doctors that had our old fax number. The faxes would come into the hospital and they would cross out our names and put their locum's names in the referral slot. They removed us from the medical record so we could no longer get access to our patients' records without going through a medical records request form and printout. And so it was this constant string of just annoyances. Now, I don't really know how this story plays out in other markets because Santa Fe is a fairly small market. I mean, we cover 330,000 people and
yep.
it's a pretty small community. So our strategy of talking to the public and working with public policy, I think was very successful because it was a smaller market. But those are some of the examples. It gets worse. They recently have weaponized their Epic medical record system. They removed us from the drop down menu for consults.
Yeah.
Then they're starting to mess with our surgeons. So their block times are changing. Our breast surgeons that have reconstructive cases can no longer schedule with their plastic surgeon, who's the only one in town. And
this is in reference to their hospital.
This is the hospital
privileges
OR.
And we've seen that across the country too on the surgery issue. Actually, recently, not that long ago in Oregon, that our team came in and sort of helped from a public policy standpoint, put a little bit of pressure on the hospital to say, you know, is this right? So when our team came in, there were several steps that we took to introduce Nexus to some of the policymakers on the state level. We set up several meetings. We call it internally our New Mexico Roadshow. We had about 15 to 20 meetings, I think, set up that from Albuquerque all the way to Santa Fe. We met with members, just an introduction of who Nexus was. You know, community, multi-specialty discipline, practice, providing X amount of care. We're in the lower cost setting as a comparatively to the higher cost hospital setting. And I think that was really eye-opening to a lot of the elected officials as well, because they maybe weren't familiar with some of the differences and how you guys can provide care. So before we jumped into any of like the issues, we were really focused on just the introduction of who Nexus was. Did you feel like that was helpful and beneficial?
Yeah, it was exceptionally helpful because most of the things that the hospital was really doing can only be done in some degree of, I don't want to call it secrecy, but under the noses of everyone. Mm-hmm. Hospitals have this wonderful, and trust me, hospitals are necessary. We need them. I'm just not entirely sure we need to have all of our outpatient care under that umbrella, right?
Mm-hmm.
Their narrative is we take care of everyone and we need this extra reimbursement and we have these extra costs because of JCO, et cetera, et cetera. And some of that is largely correct. But when they start lumping every service they provide under this umbrella and arbitrarily increasing the cost of care over and over again, that narrative begins to lose power. The general public and even the policymakers don't really dig far enough to understand that. They just don't. So there so much was needed about just turning the light on to what the cost of care was and what the hospital was doing. And that act in itself gave us some legitimacy, and the pressure would ease off with each subsequent sort of introduction. Because they just didn't, you know, they knew all of the things they were doing were pretty shady. It just became harder and harder for them to do it the more people started watching. And so that was that was very useful, probably more useful than any specific, you know, targeted action, was just beginning the dialogue and making people aware.
Yeah. And I think we still have a lot of work that needs to be done. I don't think that our issues are solved yet, but our biggest step was introducing you, introducing other physicians. I know we hosted a dinner with the healthcare committee, both in the House and Senate, really placing you guys as thought leaders. So when we do come to these elected officials with issues, not just on this issue, but down the road, we've already have a relationship with them. They already see you as a leader in healthcare, as an expert in this space. And so, you know, I think we still have some other meetings that we have pending to really hit home on some of this anti-competitive behavior we are seeing. In the past year, our work that we've done with you, how has this affected your relationship with other independent practices in Santa Fe?
Well, that was really interesting and kind of an unexpected benefit to all of this work, because you're right. You really did sort of position us, even though we're not new to the market, but Nexus Health is a new entrant to the market. We were all of a sudden given a legitimacy in the policymakers' eyes because of the work your team did. And so all of a sudden, when we had a dinner or when we met with people, there was some recognition and some assumed knowledge base. And we can all judge quietly to ourselves whether or not that was earned. But that was enormously helpful. And what was so fascinating was the response of the other independent groups in our city. And there's not a ton, right? There's a GI group and a nephrology group and then a smattering of primary care. But what the public policy team did and for us is they brought resources to the table that no private practice by themselves could do. So all of these doctors would go down to the legislative area on White Coat Day. And that was pretty much their contribution on an annual basis. When we were able to host that dinner, we invited the other private groups in town to make it more of a, this is an independent, lower cost, better care discussion. And every one of those groups who had been sitting on the sidelines waiting to see if Nexus Health is going to make it or not, then decided we better work with these guys. And that was
just another ally.
Yeah. It was enormously helpful.
One of the things that I think is all forgotten in, you know, this battle that you guys have had to deal with is the patient aspect. And that's one of the things that our team tries to bring to these policymakers is how the patients are the ones who end up suffering the most when they aren't being allowed to, you know, go see you and your relationship that you may have had before previously. How have you guys, you know, been able to manage and sort of deal with that going, you know, throughout this entire process? And have you had patients come to you and be like, where have you gone and why can't we see you anymore?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting question. And I think to some degree, it's sort of an American question. Discussion of cost of care is very important to people in an abstract way, right? Oh, it's too bad. It's too much of our GDP. Nobody really engages with it, though. But two things, when you get down to what's the actual out-of-pocket to people, and two, are you messing with patient choice?
Yep.
Those are like huge hot button issues. And again, I do think it's a little American. Like, we get really touchy about taking away our right to choose. Universally, every public policy person we talk to, every legislator we talk to, when you talk about removing a patient's choice to choose the doctor they want, man, does that get people's attention. Yeah. It really does. And so every time we get a patient letter, we get an email, we couldn't find you, we had been told you left. Just last week, I was in the hospital and I was assigned a Christus oncologist. My husband was treated by you. My neighbor was treated by you. Will you please consider taking me as a patient? Like, the patient doesn't even know they have the ability to direct that.
Right.
And I think, yeah, that's one of the big issues that's lost that, you know, as part of the educational piece that we try to deliver because, yeah, patients, unless you're a part of this system, that does get lost. And when you're at a hospital setting, you don't really know, you know, what are the other options out there. So I think this is a big piece, too, that hospitals have really a tactic that they've been trying to, you know, just eliminate anybody else from even trying to get in, which ultimately hurts patients.
It does.
And it's trust, too. So your patient that's referring you to an oncologist, you want to assume that you're trusting them in their judgment. And so that's why a lot of patients do go with who they're being referred to. And the fact that this system has basically prohibited any primary or internal physician to even refer to you, even if you are their trusted oncologist, that they would want to. So we're taking away patient choice, but we're also taking away the choice of other physicians, right?
Yeah.
That's been an aspect of this that has been so personally disappointing to me, is because when I refer one of my patients to someone, I'm sort of entrusting that they're going to care for my patient, right? And I've been shocked and slightly disappointed in the fact that some of the hospitalists or subspecialists that have been employed by Christus have really gone along with the quote unquote keep it purple referral directive they've been given. It's really hard for me to understand knowingly sending your patient to a locum tenens with a new diagnosis of breast cancer or colon cancer. In no universe is that adequate care.
Well, in claiming continuity of care.
Yeah, absolutely. Which they rotate through. That's been hard for me. But I've watched physicians for 20 years give away their power to employers and hospitals and payers over and over again, all the time lamenting behind the scenes that it's not like it used to be. Well, they were willing participants in that process, and they traded their power and their autonomy for quote unquote security.
Well, on that, can I ask, how's your relationship with the U.S. Oncology Network? Do you feel like, I mean, our whole goal, and especially our team from a policy standpoint, is to protect physician independence, to protect your autonomy, and to protect our patient access to timely, affordable care in the community setting. And we want to make sure that we're building and fostering dialogue between you, the expert, the physician, and policymakers to make sure that policy recommendations align with that.
It's really interesting because I can't imagine how an independent practice or private practice that's not part of a larger network could really engage meaningfully in some of these discussions. There's simply just not the resources nor the time to do it. And there are some organizations like COA that give you opportunities to do that. And it's still such a very brief introduction, and it's hard to walk away feeling like you accomplished much. The U.S. Oncology Network is, I'll give you guys some props here, right? They've been enormously helpful and engaged, and it's been a conversation. It is still challenging from a time perspective to you know, have the conversations you need to have to change policy. It's an enormous amount of work. But it is so much more satisfying to be in that dialogue versus going to Washington for a day, getting a piece of paper with three hot button issues that I'm supposed to go talk to a policymaker about in 7 seconds when they really want, you know, do you want a picture or coffee? Well, actually, I would prefer not either. I would prefer you to understand this argument, but that is not happening.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Dr. Herbert, for joining us on the Link podcast, linking physicians to policy.
And we'll catch you all after the break, and hopefully we'll be able to have a couple more guests join us after the lunch break.
Thank you guys both very much for your time and having me talk. I appreciate it.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for listening to the Link podcast, your link to the legislature.
For more information on healthcare policy and the U.S. Oncology Network, visit www.legislink.com.